This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary, and we're meeting on April 30th, 1987 at 3 o'clock p.m. in Hearing Room 343. This will be a public hearing on Senate Bills 138, 154, 631, 733, 793, 870, 915, and 1016, as well as House Bill 2298.
Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Senators Wires and Fryer here as a subcommittee to take public testimony on Senate Bill 631. Lee Hockman, you're sitting up here, and we've got John Gilmore and Jeffrey Davis with you. Is that who's there?
Yes.
All right, gentlemen, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I am Jeff Davis with Marion County Health Department and here representing the Mental Health Directors Association. Our testimony today with regards to Senate Bill 31 is in relation to the proposed amendments that are before you titled SB 631-1, and I will stop at this point and turn it over to Lee Hockman.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for some time the local community mental health programs have been working on approaches in dealing with the emergency hospitalization of mental health clients in the local communities. This process is a dual responsibility both by the mental health division and the local community mental health programs. We've had some problems in various communities because of the lack of controls on cost. This bill, as proposed to be amended, would do really three things. One, it would help control where the emergency mental ill clients are admitted and allow for contractual agreements between the hospitals and the local community mental health programs. It would also keep hospitals from billing and being reimbursed for unrelated and sometimes unneeded services to the local mental health programs. And third, it should establish an equitable source of last resort reimbursement rate based upon reasonable cost. Although the legislation will not offset cost increases in other mental health areas, it is a cost reduction effort which will allow limited treatment funds to be used for direct mental health care in the local communities. We would appreciate your consideration.
All right. Any other comments by either of you two gentlemen? All right. Senator Wires, any questions?
No questions.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. We have one other witness sign up, Barry Cast.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Barry Cast. I'm here representing Joseph Murray, Administrator of the Mental Health Division. Oh. We lend support to the bill with the amendments that have been drafted by legislative counsel. We feel strongly that these costs must be brought under control, and we feel that administrative rule is the proper procedure to do so. We have submitted testimony from Mr. Murray, which sets forth these amendments and our justification for them. I have nothing further to add.
Right. Thank you very much. Senator Wire, any questions?
No.
All right. That'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 631. We could go ahead with this. You want to go ahead with the same?
Whatever you want to do? Sure, yeah. Good idea.
All right. Now, with reference to Senate Bill 915, bring me the sign-up sheet on 915, please. We've been... I'm the only one in the building, apparently, that's got a copy of this major amendment to this bill, and I was kind of waiting until the other committee members had a chance to get that. But we're going to proceed with testimony on Senate Bill 915 anyway. Okay, now, Don McClay, were you going to be the first witness? Or,
yes.
All right, fine. You come on up.
915.
Well, thank you very much for letting, the courtesy of letting us go first. We do have a problem that requires that does not allow us to sit here for 2 hours waiting.
You don't have the luxury of a lot of time like people serving the legislature.
Exactly.
Is that what you're
saying? No, not indeed. We have a physical problem, and I appreciate your thoughtfulness. Senator Frey, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Donald S. McClave. I am the father of Susan McClave, one of seven students and two faculty members from the Oregon Episcopal School who perished while climbing Mount Hood last May. With me this afternoon, lending their moral support, are Brenton Clark on my left and Giles Thompson, who are the only survivors of what was the worst accident ever on Mount Hood and one of the worst mountaineering tragedies of all time anywhere in North America. We are here along with representatives of Oregon's entire mountain rescue community and on behalf of the thousands upon thousands of climbers throughout the world whose eyes are upon us in this hearing room today. The bill which Senator Simmons has introduced and with the amendments that have been added to it, Senate Bill 915, will revolutionize mountain rescue and save countless lives in the future. We are here to support that effort. To illustrate why this bill is so important, let me describe for you the circumstances of last year's accident. The climbing party, which Brenton, Giles, and my daughter Susan were part of, left Timberline Lodge early on the morning of May 12, 1986, on a climb to the summit of Mount Hood. Late that afternoon, they were trapped by a severe blizzard while attempting to descend from the upper level of the mountain. After becoming lost, they prudently elected to seek shelter for the night in a snow cave some 2,000 feet above the lodge. Now, the average spring storm on Mount Hood lasts for about 6 to 8 hours, but this was not an ordinary storm. It was, in fact, one of terrible intensity, and it lasted for more than 30 hours after it began on the afternoon of May 12. When I arrived at Mount Hood on the morning of May 13, rescue operations were already underway in spite of the incredibly difficult conditions. Snowcat drivers were transporting climbers up the mountain in zero visibility to the estimated location of the cave. And on several occasions, they actually dropped off rescuers within a few hundred feet of the stranded climbers. But it was impossible to see or hear anything because of the storm. Finally, on the evening of May 13, the storm ended, and rescuers searched all night long using flashlights, flares, and headlights from the snowcats. But by then, the cave had been covered over by drifting snow and couldn't be located. When daybreak came on May 14, clear skies allowed the use of rescue helicopters, and within 20 minutes or so, the bodies of three victims were found lying in the snow. Now, as it happened, they were within just a few feet of the entrance to the cave, but there was no way to know that at the time. On May 15, just a few minutes before the scheduled 6 p.m. cessation of search activities, an exhausted rescuer pushed his probe into the snow one last time and located the cave. Brenton and Giles were saved, thank God. But after 3 days in the snow, it was too late for anyone else. The rescuers had run out of time. It seems appropriate at this point to acknowledge the heroic effort which was made by the rescue groups. They worked incessantly for nearly 60 hours to locate the climbers, often at peril to their own safety. Everything that could possibly have been done was done, and I'll always be grateful to the rescue groups for that. Next, I'd like to comment on the cause of the accident, as determined by an independent investigation board and summarized in the report which has been distributed to you. The board concluded that the primary cause of the accident was the failure of the climb leadership to turn back at an earlier hour when the group's energy reserves would have been greater. And I make this point not to condemn the climb leader, Father Thomas Goman, but rather to point out that even climbers as experienced and careful as Tom had been over 25 years of climbing sometimes make mistakes or become ill. It has happened many times in the past, and unfortunately, it will happen again in the future. Signal devices often give climbers a second chance under these circumstances. And although they are not a panacea for every possible problem which can arise during a climb, signal devices of the type which are going to be described for you in a few moments can save lives by helping rescuers locate stranded climbers much, much faster. 9 lives would have been saved last May if these devices had been available, as would countless others in previous accidents over the years. The good news is that you can act here in this room today to save the lives of the climbers who will become stranded in Oregon's mountains in the future. Dick Konstam and Dave Hitchcock are going to tell you about the Mountain Signal Memorial Fund and the electronic signal devices which can prevent a reoccurrence of last year's disaster. Craig Petrie, who is co-chairman of the Mountain Signal Memorial Fund, perhaps said it best in a recent interview with Sports Illustrated magazine, and I quote, "It's ironic. We have the technology to see people in Red Square from outer space and to track caribou from thousands of miles away, but we don't have an effective system for finding someone who is lost in the woods," end quote. Please, please stop this senseless situation from continuing any longer. Please vote yes on Senate Bill 915 and let Oregon lead the way in allowing sophisticated technology to save lives in our mountains. On behalf of Brenton and Giles, and myself, I thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I would be pleased to answer any questions which you might have.
All right, thank you. Any questions, Senator Hamby? Senator Wires?
It's nice to meet you folks, though. We all, I'm sure everybody in this room read about the tragedy and followed it and hoped that more people would survive, and we're glad that at least two did. Kind of heroes, and we read about you, and glad you made it. I climbed Mount Hood once and fell in the chute coming down the north face of Mount Hood and slid partway down and a rope. There were 4 of us roped in, and we managed to stop, partly by luck, but it was nothing like what this was. We didn't have any snow on us or anything.
Okay, Don, thanks again. Thank you,
Senator. We appreciate your courtesy in letting us go first.
All right. I would suggest, unless you have a different idea, Don, that I call, Senator Simmons, did you want to say anything?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Come ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I introduced this bill at the request of the people who are appearing here today for several reasons. One, I have been involved in mountain rescue for a good many years and can appreciate the problems that they have faced and that their rescuers have faced. I tried to bring a bill with the amendments that can be an appropriate one for the purpose and which will also pass the constitutional questions of the limitation of liability. I have met many times with people who have this interest and are expressing it today. I think they can better express the details than I can. My only thought is that I know from personal experience what it is to find a body on a mountain, to know that I have walked or skied by that same place during the night and missed it when there was still a chance to have saved a life. I think that if this bill can save one life, of course, it will be very worthwhile. And I would solicit your support of the bill. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to ask or to answer.
Any questions of Senator Simmons? Senator Hamby.
Chair, yes. Senator, are the amendments that you spoke to, Stephen Kefauri amendments dated April 30?
Yes, those are the ones that were prepared by Randall Kester, who is a former member of the Supreme Court of Oregon and has long been interested in mountain rescue and mountain safety.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Senator, for being here.
Thank you.
All right, Randall Kester. Yeah, all right, Judge, whatever you say, have him come up.
My name is Dick Constam, and I've been operator of Timberline Lodge for 31 years. In fact, I start my 32nd year tomorrow. During these past 31 years, I've been witness to many mountain climbing accidents. In the time since records have been kept, 50 wilderness fatalities have been associated with Mount Hood. Of the many, many searches and rescues that have ended up on a less severe note, one aspect that has always been strikingly apparent is the great anguish on the part of friends and relatives who stand and wait for the news. Not a year goes by without some search and rescue on the mountain, and you must remember that the searchers are often putting their lives in jeopardy also. Often, too, these searches take days and days to carry out. Following this last and most severe mountain tragedy, I was quoted on local television as asking for the implementation of a locating device that could quickly and easily pinpoint lost climbers. Simultaneously with this, and almost miraculously, a group of experienced and hardened mountain people came together and said, we must formulate a system and find a tool specifically for the purpose of locating those who are lost. This Ag Hot Committee later came to be called the Mountain Signal Memorial Group. Money was meanwhile starting to pour in from such diverse sources as private corporations, church groups, youth groups, bank employees, car clubs, schools, artist workshops, and the Scouts, just to name a few. The newly formed citizen group was composed of people from the County Sheriff's Office, the 304th Air Rescue Squadron, Portland Mountain Rescue, a ski area on Mount Hood, the Mazamas, the Mount Hood Ski Patrol, the U.S. Forest Service, the State Emergency Management Division, and from one U.S. Senator's office and one Congressman's office. With this deep concern from the mountain community, the focus was definitely on some form of locating beacon. I should mention here that the Mountain Signal Group was formally meeting as early as May 19th, within the same week that the climbing tragedy had occurred. One of the first items on the agenda was to make inquiries both by phone and by mail throughout the world in an effort to find out what others had discovered in the realm of tracking devices. We canvassed Scandinavia, the Alps, Australia, New Zealand in particular, and we set up testing criteria and began systematically examining and testing different devices as they arrived from everywhere. It must be pointed out here that the Mountain Signal Group has no intent whatsoever to make the wearing or carrying of a signal device obligatory. Think of it, as you will, as a flashlight on a camping trip. If you go camping, you should know how to build a campfire or pitch a tent. And learning to be a good camper is probably the most important thing. But if you have any sense at all and are camping overnight, you will probably take a flashlight. In this day and age of electronic wizardry, it's easy to carry along a lightweight locating device on a potentially dangerous trip, much like a flashlight on a camping trip. As the weeks slipped into months, our search went on, but we got the first inkling of what we wanted from a correspondent in New Zealand who told us of a device the search and rescue division in their country, country's Department of Transportation, had been using. A similar equipment setup, we were told, was being formulated and manufactured in the state of Arizona. At the same time all this research was going on, there were subcommittees working on fundraising, methodology, implementation, and the legal and liability aspects of locating devices. We soon realized that whales can be tracked in the Bering Sea, but that a couple of lost mushroom hunters in Oak Ridge, Oregon, cannot be found. The reason we can't find these folks is not that we don't have the technology, because we do, but rather that a problem exists regarding the legal ramifications for the manufacturers and the distributors of devices and for their searchers themselves. I can tell you that it caused me utmost anxiety to order employees out on a stormy winter night to go look for lost skiers or climbers, knowing that I may endanger their lives as well. Those who risk their lives every year on the mountain must be able to have the best electronic locating equipment possible. But the manufacturers of this best equipment will not allow it to be used to locate people because of the possibilities of lawsuits, which is why they have stayed with the animal population. We are asking you to give Senate Bill 915 your long and hard consideration. It would provide an exemption from liability for devices and personnel used in the performance of such rescue operations in Oregon. We ask you also to bear in mind the tremendous outpouring of energy and effort, which I have just described for you, by citizens trying to avert a further unnecessary tragedy, has cost the state nothing. Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Wires.
Does this amendment that we're going to be getting, I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
Is this amendment that we're going to be getting, is that going to substitute the whole act or is it just add on to it?
My understanding is that this amendment is going to be a substitute for the original bill. That's my understanding of it.
The amendment is in each of your files for Senate Bill 915, or it should be.
This bill talks, Mr. Kronstam, about limiting liability not only for a device but also for people who are taking part in rescue. Do you have people saying when this tragedy occurred, did people say they didn't want to go out because they might be liable?
No. No, that didn't happen. But in the broad sweep of things, it makes the availability of this best equipment possible. That's the major point.
I'm just trying to get a picture of what the outside boundary of this bill is. So you're mainly interested in the equipment, not in people engaging in rescue. being exempt from liability. Is that right?
Well, both, if possible, but the
equipment is the key thing. If you want both, would you tell us what has happened about people searching in the past? I think you already answered my question. You haven't had people telling you they wouldn't go out and search
because of
liability. Okay. That is my question.
Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome, constituent.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. David Hitchcock.
Good afternoon. I'm Dave Hitchcock from Portland. A bit of background, a bit of personal background might be useful before I give my testimony. My professional background is that of engineering and quality assurance. I worked for Viewmaster in Beaverton for 36 years. Currently, I'm employed as quality control manager, a position which I've held for over 15 years. Previously, I was senior test engineer supervising an engineering test lab. Mountaineering has been a lifelong activity, and I've been a member of various mountaineering rescue groups for over 30 years. As an active member of the Mounted Ski Patrol since 1955, I've been involved in all phases of the patrol, and for the last 3 years have been responsible for the patrol's avalanche rescue training. I am a member of the Mountain Signal Steering Committee, a member of the Equipment Subcommittee, and I chair the Training Subcommittee. Way back in 1976, the Mount Hood Save a Life Fund Committee was busy working on a project evaluating equipment in order to find the best possible communication equipment to be made available to climbers. The equipment was selected, and approximately $1,700 was collected. But the project died because no one was willing to loan the radios out to distribute the radios on a loan basis because of liability fears.
Yeah, Senator Wires.
Mr. Hitchcock, I've read your testimony, and the thing that I don't see in it is what is the real specific technical information about the equipment that now has been tested and found to be the best? How does it work? What did they find out about how often it works and that kind of thing? I don't exactly see that in your written testimony.
We have this is a transmitter that we propose to have issued to climbers. We have a receiver that will locate that transmitter. We received, as my testimony, if I deviate from my written testimony, as it says, we received six different units from equipment manufacturers. We tested them all on the mountain in a variety of situations and simulated rescues. The transmitter was buried in the snow, was lowered in the crevasses. The receivers were then, we would give the receiver to a would-be rescuer, and he would go out and find and locate the transmitter. The receivers were used by hand, people walking with helicopters and snowcats. We have tested them as extensively as we can. We are continuing testing them. We will continue to test them to see if there are blind spots on the mountain, and if there are blind spots on the mountain, where we can position the receiver so that we can locate that, or so we can cover that particular portion.
Is that the receiver that's in use in another state, Arizona or somewhere?
That's a receiver that's manufactured in Arizona.
Manufactured in Arizona. Well, is it being used anywhere in the world by human beings? This is a receiver that's being used on whales, is that right?
It has been used for animals. That's and I understand a similar device is being looked into in New Zealand.
Is a device like that being used anywhere in the world on human beings?
To the best of my knowledge, I don't believe so. I'm not aware of. May I ask, Scott? Are you aware of it being used anywhere else?
My name is Scott Russell, and I'm co-chairman of the fund. This is the receiving device,
And as Mr. Hitchcock has indicated, it is used basically for wildlife, and it is used in the scientific community. Some of these scientists are in extremely remote areas to try and track these animals. It is being used by some of those researchers, yes. It has been used in some cases for people in homes that have got various stages of mental dementia, such as Alzheimer's, where they wander off and they can be located. But again, the situation is far removed from a mountain wilderness and the extreme weather conditions that we're talking about. Does that answer your...
Do you think the mountain wilderness is more wilderness than the urban wilderness?
Well,
but, let's leave that for now.
Okay.
Where are they being used for people who have Alzheimer's and dementia?
There is one of these transceivers that was used in Portland by a doctor whose wife had this condition and wandered off. It is not being used on a commercial basis at this point in time. There is a parallel study going on at this time to have such a device for people with mental problems.
Who is the manufacturer? What's the name of the manufacturer?
This particular manufacturer is Telonix, and they're located in Mesa, Arizona. We have received...
If I could have the entire letter to look at, or at least enough of it so that I could put this last page in context.
Do you have it, Scott?
Okay.
It's mostly full of technical data.
Well, I can skip that part. I get the impression here, though, in reading this, that these people down in Arizona were asked to participate in some kind of an outdoor project here in Oregon to experiment with this device, and they said that they couldn't do it.
I have in front of me, Senator, about a 30-page response from this manufacturer to our request for proposal that we developed, and it addresses the conditions under which this device would be operating, and you're welcome to read this over, and they describe in depth what their equipment will do. As far as the problem that, the hypothetical problem that you've posed, that would quite easily be handled because each of these devices would be available to ensure its proper operation when a climber checked out and left Timberline Lodge. I wouldn't want to go up there, you hand me a black box, and I can't tell if it's working or not. I would want to know that, in fact, it was working before I went up there, and our distribution system would ensure that that not only would be working when the climber checked it out from a distributor, but at the wilderness boundary or point of departure, in this case, Timberline Lodge, we would, at this point, are anticipating having a detector that the person could verify it was operating. The problem that the manufacturer is very much concerned about is the beer bottle incident that you described occurring up on the mountain, which is certainly out of the manufacturer's control and certainly out of our control.
I know what this, I think Senator Wires was talking about the amendment here, which would include anybody up on the mountain who gave this device to somebody else, is not confined just to the manufacturer. See? So I think here's the concern I sense that some of us are kind of wrestling with here. And I think that you all would agree with this principle that we have a situation that we want to try and correct. We have an incident that we don't want to be repeated, but we at the same time we don't want to put into the hands of our mountain climbers, particularly the young people like we're on this particular trip, any kind of device or anything else that was likely to be to have even fatal results without some assurance that that device at least had been
tested in accordance with some standards or manufactured in accordance with some standards. We don't want to jeopardize the young climbers by giving them a false sense of security by saying, here, take this out, you know, and it's going to be a surefire thing. We want to make sure at least that these are safe for these people, don't we? We'd all agree on that.
I agree with that concept, and this letter will explain to you how thoroughly they do test their equipment. The consequences of this thing not working gets us right back to the way mountain climbing is today and has been since people have climbed mountains. If it fails, you're in the same situation that you are today. It is not making your situation any more dangerous. And if there's a reason that this device should not be used, it would be specifically that false sense of security that you described.
Yeah, that's the real bad part of it.
And we do not encourage that concept at all. Quite simply, with this device, your chances of being located are increased hundreds, if not thousands, of times over. Without it, you're in the same situation that you would be today if you decided to climb the mountain.
That's precisely true if this works, and that's, you know, that's the area that we're struggling with now. How can we assure that when someone takes these out, they're likely to work? That's what I'm hoping that we, you know, can pin down here. Make sure that if we're going to eliminate liability for the manufacturer or the producer of these devices, that at least we've taken all reasonable steps to assure mountain climbers in Oregon that they've got a reasonable basis of expectation, you know, some kind of a right to rely on this thing. And I think that's what we all want.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Perhaps I can help resolve this with suggesting some language.
Fine.
part of what was discussed a few minutes ago, you might correct just by adding at the very end the words resulting from the use of such device. In other words, then it would say no person may maintain an action for injury incurred during wilderness travel or mountain climbing resulting from the use of such device. And then you could go still farther if you want to and say unless the failure of the device was due to an intentional act on the part of the user, something like that. I'm sure that your committee counsel could add an exemption for malicious intent.
Okay, fine. Well, I'm sure counsel may be in touch with you on that, Judge, and I think we're kind of agreed now that we've pointed out some of the potential pitfalls in the present language that what we want to do is make sure we've got the right words here so these things won't happen. Yes, Senator Brenneman.
Just for a point of clarification for me, the big problem is in this device or these devices you're looking at is that none of them are manufactured for mountaineering. They're used for other purposes.
That is correct.
And are there suitable tracking devices for mountaineering currently available?
To our knowledge, from our inquiries throughout the mountain climbing community, not only in this country, but in several of the countries that we've sent inquiries to, no such device exists for this purpose.
Okay.
Perhaps it should be amplified. There are devices that serve a somewhat similar function, but in a different way. They have plates that you can put on your boots, which serve as a radar reflector, but they're a very short range and don't do what this device does.
One more.
Go ahead, sir.
About these devices that are used by pilots that emit a beep when you go down, that's not a practical situation to use those.
That's quite similar to this device. One of the big problems with that device is they currently have a 97% false alarm rate. That's quite distressing to our search and rescue folks. Also, the frequency that they use is closed only to the use by FAA and Coast Guard. They have other problems, too, in their physical size as far as being used on the mountains, but it's a very similar type of system to what we propose.
All right, Senator Hamby.
And there is no unit of government like the Coast Guard or some such unit that is currently testing this device that we can, I share the chair's concern about you know, including every single manufacturer of every tracking device. Is there some way that we could somehow narrow the scope? Something hasn't been tested by the Coast Guard. Has it been tested at all, other than, you know, FCC?
The testing of this particular device has been carried out in the field for 20 some years. This particular company has the bulk of the research community's business because of their reliability. But as far as a specific test to do what we propose to do, I am not aware of that being done outside of our committee, which I might add is composed of lots of people in the electrical field.
And you feel strongly that we need to include manufacturer, distributor, seller, and supplier, all of them, rather than just simply the manufacturer?
Well, I'm not an attorney, and I can't speak exactly to everybody's exposure in that area, but I am very concerned about all people concerned with this, in that they participate in the program as the Mountain Signal Memorial Fund members themselves.
Judge, or
Senator Hamby, I think perhaps the answer to that is that it would depend on the manner in which it is actually put into use. And as was said earlier, the exact method of distribution hasn't been settled upon, but conceivably they could be rented out by a mountain equipment like REI or G.I. Joe's. You can rent an ice axe or crampons or a sleeping bag or whatever. Maybe they would install these and rent them out, but they wouldn't want to do so unless they had some assurance that somebody's not going to come back on them if the gadget doesn't happen to work under the emergency conditions of a mountain search. So we feel it is necessary to include the supplier. Now, whether it was a commercial store such as that or an organization such as the Mazamas or the Boy Scouts or the Episcopal School, whatever, they should not be exposed to a risk that would induce them not to use the device. And that's the key to the whole thing. Unless we can somehow alleviate the risk, we're not going to get the use of the device at all, and then we're right back where we started.
Senator Hill.
In cases, is there any case law on other similar devices? And if I missed that part of discussion.
I have previously submitted a memorandum to the chairman. I'll make more copies available if the committee wants them. I did some research on this for the Mountain Signal Memorial Fund. There's nothing that is exactly the same, but there are some similarities. For example, smoke detectors in a house. There have been cases where a person has sued the manufacturer of a smoke detector saying it didn't work, therefore I lost my house or I lost it more than I would have. There have been such cases. There's a lot of automobile cases saying that...
Have they prevailed? Have the plaintiffs prevailed in those cases?
It can go either way. They can make a jury question on it. In some of the automobile cases, for example, the manufacturer's been sued saying that the design of the car was such that while it didn't cause the accident, it made the damage worse. For example, a door flies open or a seat belt doesn't hold or something like that. And the aggravation of the damages has been the basis for some recovery. So the manufacturer's concern here is not entirely imaginary.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add on to that, the theory has been strict liability, so an exemption from negligence does not help.
Of course, this bill goes way beyond trying to protect against the doctrine of strict liability.
I understand that.
Yeah. I mean, Senator Hill, go ahead.
They're actually rescue devices, though. I'm trying to focus this narrowly. There are devices that when people are shipwrecked and those kinds of things. I mean, do you have any cases that deal with those situations?
I have not found any cases. There are cases of signal buoys that didn't work. But then the action is against the government and then under the Tort Claims Act, which involves considerations that we don't have here. I have not found any case precisely in point on this.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any further questions by committee members? Council.
Can you describe how this device gets turned on? Is it always on from the time it leaves the plant? Is it turned on by the person who supplies it? Is it turned on by the climber when they get in trouble? How does it get activated?
Senator, this particular device would be activated by the climber when he feels that he is in a situation where he needs somebody to find him. The frequency would not be monitored on a 24-hour basis, but would, in fact, be monitored when a rescue is called out.
So you'd have climbers going through the same procedure they're going through now of registering.
Correct.
And letting people know they're on the mountain.
That's
and
correct.
And when they don't return by a projected time, if they had checked one of these things out, the receiver would be hauled out and they'd see if they could find them.
That's correct, in addition to the normal activation of a rescue.
Is it conceivable that somebody could be in a situation where they could be harmed so quickly that they would not have a chance to turn on the device?
That situation could occur, and I didn't add it into, or it was not in this testimony, but we have such an additional device attached to this. It's extremely lightweight. It's extremely inexpensive in as a comparison. But its disadvantage is it's a close-range device designed for avalanche use. There's no turning it on. There's no turning it off. It's always on. The problem with that device is, again, the distance in which it transmits over. But we do intend to incorporate that with this device to cover that precise situation.
If I might add that, the theory of using this radio device is that there will be more than one of them in the party, hopefully at least two, but maybe more. But if a person falls in a crevasse and it happens so quick he can't pull the plug or whatever is necessary to turn on, somebody else in the party could do so.
Now, just so we've got the record perfectly clear, Judge Kester, present time, if you could go out and buy these devices, you could go ahead with the FCC approval, I understand, and provide them to the mountain climbers.
If you could get them. I guess the answer is a practical one. They just aren't available unless we can give the manufacturer this kind of protection.
Well, at least that's true with one manufacturer. But, I mean, I heard from earlier testimony that there's you've got one here, somebody else has got one down on the coast, and somebody else got one here and there, and their manufacturers in, where did I hear, Illinois? And where?
New Zealand.
New Zealand. So, but anyway, that at least, assuming you could get the things, I guess you could use them, couldn't you?
I know of no legal prohibition against it except the possible effects of the product liability statute.
All right. Okay. Thanks. Thanks. Yes. Senator Hill.
The one analogy that seems to come to mind for me is that there are a lot of people who do skydiving, and obviously the parachute, I mean, it's even more immediate than I think than what your situation is, because if it doesn't open or if it's flawed, I mean, you really do stand a chance of death of it. Do parachute makers have something like this? I mean, where they're exempt? Because they've obviously got to do it right. I mean, you can investigate it to see if the chute was flawed in some way. And
if I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, the problem is that this is a really unique device used for a very small number of people. And it's just not, parachutes can be used by lots of, they're used by a lot of people around. And there are a lot of people who make them. There's only one person that makes this particular device. It's good enough to meet the standards of this club. And they've checked through everybody in the world that makes anything like this. There's one device that they want to use here. There's only one that's good enough. There are, a couple thousand people that climb Mount Hood a year. On a weekend, there may be five or six parties going up. If each one of those parties has two or three devices, you're talking about a very small number of devices to be made. There's no way that they can make these just for climbers. The way they make these is for animals and for other kinds of use. So the problem is that there's no incentive for them to sell these to climbers. They get nothing back for it. The small amount they sell, they can't sell enough to purchase liability insurance. So it's just a flat question of either we have them or we don't have them. Either we pass a bill that exempts them from liability or we don't have them. That's the bottom line.
If I could add a word, Senator Hill, perhaps an answer to the parachute question is this. if the parachute fails, that is the cause of the accident. If this thing fails, it doesn't make the climber in any worse position than he would have been without it, because this doesn't cause the accident which made the rescue necessary. This is something that comes later to help eliminate the effects of the accident, which has already happened. It's not like a wheel coming off a car where that is the cause of the injury.
I understand what you're saying, sir. I guess it's just that you have, in fact, the causal connection in a way, I don't know, to me makes the argument stronger. I mean, you know that if a person with a parachute, if the parachute fails, I mean, they're going to be held liable. And they know that, and apparently they're willing to assume the risk of that and make their product well. But I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, we don't have any. We're just going to have to move along. I'm afraid, gentlemen. I appreciate very much the your willingness to kind of exchange, give us this exchange here. But you can see right away that there are questions by committee members about the breadth of this proposal. Okay, let's see. Now we have one more witness signed up, and that's the Sheriff Bill Brooks. Is he here, Sheriff?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to come up and kind of? And then in the meantime, I think I would ask, if you don't mind, Mr. Russell?
Yes.
If you don't mind, would you give the page? I think I would like to see the letter that you've been referring to. And if you don't mind, why, we'll have the page run off a copy of it. All right, Sheriff, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I realize you're under a time constraint, so I'll be brief. A couple of things. It's my understanding that Mount Hood is the second most climbed mountain in the world. Mount Fuji is number one. They get about 12,000 climbers a year on Mount Hood. The reason I'm here today is that I believe that some exceptional legislation is needed simply to abolish the tort liability with respect to the mountain signal communication locator and the beacon and the related equipment. What we've heard today is that the technology is here, and this is a can-do way of providing a life safety factor to those who might otherwise perish without it. In other words, to give the climber the edge, but not like the parachute, which might be the proximate cause of the problem. We've heard some hypothetic horror stories here today about opening beer cans or pounding these things with beer bottles, but I suggest with the distinguished experts that we have assembled in this room, we could probably tell a hypothetical success story, maybe on a scale of 1 to 10 for every horror story. But that isn't leading us to what we really need to do, and that is to see the Oregon legislature take some bold leadership to make sure that the Good Samaritans do not face the undeserved trauma of defending oneself for product liability or the liability in connection with the acquisition, supply, distribution, use, or failure of the signal equipment to perform, and this performance under sometimes very extraordinary circumstances. The bottom line is, would we be better off with it or without it? And I think that is the question to which you would have the remedy. Thank you very much, sir.
I don't have any problem with the Good Samaritans. I am wondering, and I think other people are wondering, about the manufacturer. The Good Samaritans ought to be protected. They didn't make this thing. They didn't beat on with beer bottles, and they're probably acting in good faith. But if the manufacturer, through extreme lack of care, put something in the hands of the Good Samaritan that the Good Samaritan and the mountain climber relied upon, I don't know if we ought to really go that far. So I think what we're going to try to do is figure out if there's a way to protect the Good Samaritan, but not say at the same time to every manufacturer in the country, you're invited to send defective products into Oregon because you got, immunity.
Maybe I should have been more specific in referring to the Good Samaritans as our mountain signal people, who are very concerned.
I think you're right on that, Sheriff. Any questions, Sheriff?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Brennan.
A lot of statements being made, I guess at this point, I'd say I'm perfectly comfortable with the CAFORI amendments that are presented to us today, and I don't share the other committee members' feelings, maybe in some regards.
Any questions of the witness? Okay, Sheriff, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 915. Now let me just take a minute here and see what I can do to... There are a lot of folks back here, and we're not going to get to all these bills, and I don't want you to wait here the rest of the evening and be disappointed. So if you'll just be patient, I'll try to figure out what bills we'll be able to hear. Okay, we're going to... All right, we're going to do... we're going to do Senate Bill 1016. Oh, wait a minute now. Yes, all right, we'll do Senate Bill 1016, then we'll do Senate Bill 154, and my guess is that that's probably all we're going to get to today. I know that there are some members of this committee that have another legislative matter on today's agenda, so they're going to have to leave here at 5. Do you think those two bills are going to take 25 minutes? Now let's see. Let's see the sign-up list on those two. That is 154. Oh my God!
154.
154 and 10. All right. Short my.
Well, why don't you let that one just testify?
Judge,
yeah.
Lady. Union Pacific General Counsel. Got a brain.
I'm looking at the Senate bill. I'm still trying to get this figured out so I can accommodate as many people, especially those from out of town, as possible. Senate Bill 1016. Is Mr. Lawrence still here? All right. Now, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go to Senate Bill 793 because... among other persons, there's someone from California, and I know it's not going to be too convenient to come back from California. So we're going to go to Senate Bill 793, and then I don't see anybody on Senate Bill 154 that is from out of town. I could be wrong. Anybody on 154 from out of town? Well, okay, Ruth, I see you. You should have put your address on here.
She says she's from California.
Okay. Well, all right. We'll do the best we can here on these things. Anyway, I'm going to say to the rest of you now that we're not going to, outside of those bills, 793, 154, and 1016... we're not going to get anywhere else. So if you're here on any other bill, we'll just have to reschedule it. Now, on Senate Bill 793, is it Margie Sherman and Charles Ferber together on this?
Yeah.
Okay, that's
we'll
good.
We'll try and speed things up that way.
Good.
I appreciate your indulgence.
Yes, thank you very much.
We'll wait just a minute till we get the mob quiet out there. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Margie Sherman. I'm here today on behalf of Old Republic Surety Company and Western Surety Company, the requesters of Senate Bill 793. And with me is Mr. Chuck Ferber from the National Notary Association. Senate Bill 793 is a reinstatement of the bond requirement for notaries public. The bond was on the statutes since 1854. It was repealed in 1983, along with the oath. We believe that the public should be protected by mistakes or willful negligence on behalf of notaries. I have given you copies of several documents. I won't go through my complete testimony. Seven other states have now instituted the $10,000 bond requirement. Those include Washington, California, Idaho, and Nevada. The Model Notary Act has within its requirements the $10,000 bond and has been endorsed by the National Association of Secretaries of State. In your packet is an article from the Oregonian which relays a case where a son forged signatures on a second mortgage and tried to sell his father's house out from under him. Luckily, the title company secretary caught the discrepancy and the gentleman was saved from losing his home. Acts of forgery are typically the most misrepresentation of person is the most likely problem with notaries. I have put in your packet information of claims from other states. We can't document to you how many claims would have been filed in the last 4 years because obviously there haven't been. We haven't had a bond. Prior to that time, the bond was $500, and consumers and particularly attorneys were not willing to go to the time and effort and expense to file a claim on such a nominal amount. Oregon has always prided itself on consumer legislation, and this is another piece of it, and I appreciate your support. I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Ferber so he can get back on an airplane to California. Thank you.
Yes, and I appreciate your courtesy very much. My name again is Chuck Ferber. I'm the Vice President of the National